Thanks for joining us. It's another episode of Sacktown Talks. We're here with the California Public Utilities Commission President Michael Picker, my former boss.
Yes.
My former boss. I spent 6 months with you.
Or the other way around.
Yeah. it's been a little while. I haven't caught up with you in a little while, so I'm glad that we have a chance to just sit down and talk, and I hope we're able to do so just as naturally, just because, you know, just pretend the mics aren't here.
Right? All right.
Yeah. So for folks that don't know, you know, one of my goals with this podcast is to bring on Sacramento's movers and shakers, both at a community level, but also at a state agency and on a policy level. And you're both. You're quite the man around town. You're a former chief of staff to Mayor Joe Cerna, and you're now the president of the top energy regulator in the state of California. And so my hope is to just sort of chat about who you are, what you've done, and maybe explain some of the questions in energy regulation for folks listening in a layperson's terms. You know, did I miss anything in introducing you? Is there anything else we should add just for folks who are maybe listening out of context?
I worked on the Midtown Traffic Calming Project. Let's get down to business.
That's what people really care about.
Yeah.
So when I'm trying to get home off the grid, and maybe I'm on F Street and I'm trying to take F Street all the way up to Alhambra, yeah, but I've got to turn out and away from that street, and it's really trying to steer me to J Street.
It's just trying to steer you to J Street, and so the goal there is to actually take you past all those retail, particularly restaurants. A lot of my understanding of this, and there clearly was a bigger project than that, goes back to going to San Francisco with some restaurant operators, and we were walking around after we'd gone to look at a couple of restaurants, and they were talking about what was really working in the industry at the time. And it was 5 o'clock, and they said, "Well, you know, let's sit down and have a snack because we're not going to get out of here in time because of traffic." So yeah, it's going to be, you know, 3 hours from San Francisco if we hit the freeway right now. So
it's a rough drive.
Yeah. It's a rough drive. So we sat down, and they said, "Well, what do you see? You know, there's a lot of people." He said, "There's a lot of people just hanging out here in this restaurant. You know, they're having drinks." And he says, "Yeah, well, you know, why do you think that is?" "Well, the same reason we're here. We're waiting out the congestion." And they looked at me and they said, "Yeah, congestion. Congestion is our friend." And so that was part of the design of the Midtown Traffic, is to steer people through the retail quarter so they could see what there was to a lifestyle in Midtown and why they might want to stop and spend some time on their way home.
Well, I'd say it worked out well. Midtown's a very attractive location, and it's sort of, you know, that drive past J Street sort of made me want to move into Midtown when I first got into Sacramento.
Yeah. And, you know, it was just one of those things. It would also help to preserve the housing stock and to kind of stabilize the population that actually also patronizes those restaurants. It created stable neighborhoods around downtown that made a more appealing place to develop for Class A office buildings. And it supports a whole cadre of people who can work in those buildings. So I think it was a good model. And in retrospect, it was probably one of the critical things. And I think you're starting to see that same kind of effect from the Ann Rudin, Joe Cerna era on the R Street corridor, where yep, they preserved that from becoming dense office and to be mixed use.
Very cool. Very cool. Let's talk about your time as chief of staff to a mayor for a little bit, because I've been in that big building that looks like a wedding cake for about 6 or 7 years, right? And so I know what a chief of staff does in the building. I was always curious to hear what a chief of staff at the mayoral level does. I didn't realize you would get so involved in projects like that.
Well, one of the things that there never had been a chief of staff before, and so usually there
you're
was
the founder.
Joe was the founder. He wanted somebody who could step in when he wasn't around, because he was a full-time college professor. 3 days a week he was on campus. And so he knew that there needed to be somebody who could just keep things rolling when he wasn't there. And he was very explicit, because he was a community organizer, that he wanted somebody to help him build coalitions and to keep things moving. And he was really concerned about education, and he had a great staff person who worked on that, Gina Montoya, son of a daughter of Jose Montoya. And he had me to kind of deal with his economic agenda, you know, and that was really what he was about. It was a traditional kind of first generation, second generation immigrant goal of economic development, education, and equal opportunity.
When you were tasked with taking over as a, you know, it's a funny thing about government, it rarely contracts, right? So once you create that slot, hey, the mayor has a chief of staff now. You probably knew this going in. There's going to be a chief of staff for the mayor going forward.
He also was interested in whether it was possible to do structural changes in government. So it was very clear. It was politically, it was very hard to get people to pass over a lot more power to a Latino mayor, first in history.
Okay.
And so he knew he was breaking a lot of ground. So he had two things in mind. One is that he was going to have to really be a mayor for everybody, not just for the Latino community, although he did a very good job of making sure that they were represented. But he actually succeeded in representing the whole community. And at one point, he was probably the elected official, a minority elected official in the U.S. who represented a very large and majority Anglo community. And he really did a good job of that. And people thought of him as their mayor, wherever they were from. They may have disagreed with him on some things, but they kind of felt like he was actually the symbol of a city that was moving forward and that was taking care of people. So the second thing that he did is he knew that he needed to have a different kind of a model for city government to be able to move more quickly and to be able to express the vision of the elected body, the council and the mayor. And so he told me he always wanted to go for 9 votes. He knew he wouldn't get there every time, but he wanted to try to craft proposals that could get to consensus. And he also kind of cut a deal with the city manager. And Joe's job was to lead in the community, to help define the agenda that would make Sacramento a better place to live. And then the city manager's job was to lead the staff in actually achieving that. And so that was a very interesting set of conditions. I think that he hoped someday there would be a strong mayor, I think he would have liked to have been there to actually try it out. But I think that he knew that he had to really move carefully, be successful, and to create a sense that a mayor actually could be somebody who helped the community be a better place.
Can we talk about that for a little bit? This wasn't like on the cheat sheet of questions that I sent you, but I think it's an interesting question for someone who's seen it from the inside like this. At the time, the proposal for the strong mayor sort of had this idea behind it that, hey, this is what big cities do. This is sort of like how we make Sacramento a happening place. Sounds like Serna maybe wanted to see that happen at some point. Clearly our last mayor wanted to see that happen at some point. How do you feel about it?
Well, you know, they teach those two models in public administration, you know, that you have a strong mayor or you have a strong manager form of government. They're both kind of traditional. For some reason, he and Bill Edgar were very, very, very successful with this kind of coalition of two. Again, where the city manager led the organization to go where the community wanted to go, and the mayor led the community to really kind of help develop that sense. So I can't say that I have a firm feeling on this. When you look at other strong mayor kinds of governments, there's lots and lots and lots of hindrances that are put on them to actually make them less than that perfect model of strong mayor. If you go to San Francisco, a lot of power is really in the commissions, Port Commission, you know, Planning Commission. Even more than the Board of Supervisors. You go to LA and a lot of the power is in some of the bodies, particularly Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, which is where the union. So I think that there's the you go to New York and the mayor is an important figurehead, but has very little real staff. And each of the commissioners, for example, the consumer commissioner actually have fairly strong support. And in places like Portland, you go, and each of the elected council members actually heads up a department.
Interesting.
So, you know, there's real diversity, and I don't see too many pure strong mayor, strong manager governments these days.
So good arguments for both.
Yeah. And for trying other things too.
Yeah. When you look at the, sort of like the wish list of things that you would have liked to have accomplished, or that, you know, Mayor Cernan would have liked to accomplish back at that time, there's sort of like, what can we do within our term? Right. And what can we set the direction for to get accomplished, you know, down the line? Right.
Well, I think a lot of it happened. It just happened 20 years after. So I go down to DOCO and I look at what's going on there. I start to see the move into the rail yards. You know, the infrastructure is all there. The market seems to be turning that direction. I look at Township 9. I look at all of that, and I think his downtown agenda and creating a center to the region is, I think that's starting to happen. I think that a lot of the neighborhood strength that he wanted to see is still uneven. You see spots of real brilliance. You start to see a lot more neighborhood diversity. So neighborhoods that were really weak now have pockets of income stability. But there's also kind of a gentrification that's taking place in a lot of those same places. So
can we talk about that a little bit? You know, I hope you'll agree with me that this isn't a bad neighborhood I'm living in.
No, it's a great neighborhood. Yeah, it's always been a very blue-collar and diverse neighborhood, which is one of the strengths of the city.
Yeah, yeah. And then just up north to me a little bit, we have Colonial Heights, which is really gentrifying. There's some $400,000 homes being, you know, $400, $450 over there. And then Tahoe Park again.
Blame Patrick Kennedy. He moved in there and everybody flooded in after him.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
But, you know, if you take a walk over to the Colonial Heights Library, which is on 21st Avenue and on Stockton, Stockton continues to be a real eyesore. No offense to the Stockton partnership, but I think we can all agree that there needs to be some work done on Stockton. Oak Park is sort of, you know, Oak Park north of Broadway has done a wonderful job of gentrifying, if you want to call it that. But Oak Park south of Broadway between Martin Luther King, above Fruit Ridge and on the other side of Stockton, you know, kind of in that triangle, they got left behind, I feel.
You know, you can have success on economic development on the average and still fail completely in specific neighborhoods. And that was always Joe's argument, is the city is only as strong as the weakest neighborhoods. So because a lot of the pure land use decision making was in the hands of a lot of passionate activists when Joe got there, one of the first things we did was make all of the planning commissioners and all the normal activists who showed up there to oppose project get on a bus and go see what the rest of the city was like. And it was very interesting to hear some of these folks say, you know, and they thought of themselves as being fairly progressive people, saying, I didn't know there were parts of the city that are like this.
That were this bad.
Yeah. You know, a lot of it's really tough. I mean, I still can't say I understand what's going to be productive. All I knew is we needed to experiment and try lots of things. You know, one of the things that we did was a program on entrepreneurship for low-income communities, and particularly targeted high school kids. And so, you know, I went to a lot of the classes that they had, and I sat and I listened to the kids talk. And, you know, it's like they could not imagine entrepreneurship except maybe running a liquor store or being a dope dealer on a particular corner, or having a franchise fast food. Those are the only things they had ever seen brown people, African American people, Asian immigrant people doing. And so that was all that was imaginable to them. And if you can't imagine it, if you can't just imagine it, then you have very little chance and probably not much hope.
Well, you know, if there's that cliche, if you can dream it, you can achieve it. But if you can't, if you're dream, you know, if you have like, you know, at real poverty, this is what people mean when they say real poverty of mind, where you haven't been shown that this is possible. Let me build on that point a little bit. When I was, you know, back when I was working for Tony, our health and human, who's, by the
yeah,
way,
and yeah, congratulations. This is really fabulous news.
Yeah. The first woman to lead the Senate,
yeah.
Tremendously proud of, you know, the honor that I've been able to have to work under such an amazing woman, frankly. I'm also just happy for the people of the state of California, because what they have in her is a real strong legislator. You know, someone that knows how to build consensus and move forward, frankly, without having to like jam it down the throat of the House. You know, she's a master legislator. She really is.
Now, I'll always respond to a well-founded criticism, and that's what I expect from her.
But, you know, back when I was working for her, our health and human services guy was, he was out. So I wound up just taking a walk-in meeting.
Yeah.
And, it was a budget issue. I really, frankly, it was years ago and I forget exactly what the budget issue was. But this 18 or 19 year old, woman was sort of explaining the possibility, you know, basically like the social welfare programs that she's eligible for, the cash assistance that she receives, the housing assistance that she receives, and how she sort of cobbles it all together to get by. And then afterwards, you know, after she got done explaining it to me, she said, oh, when I turn 21 and when I turn 22, I'll be eligible for this. And then when I turn 25, I might be eligible for that. And if I have a kid, I might be eligible for this. And I was like, God, I mean, God, I would hope that by the time you're 20, let's get you into a 4-year school.
Yeah.
What do you mean you're eligible for more cash assistance? Let's get you into a 4-year school. Let's work, you know, let's get you connected to the resources that you need to get you, you know, to get you into college, because everyone deserves to have that opportunity. And, you know, I didn't say that to her, but I was, my jaw just kind of dropped, because exactly what you said, that was the only thing that she could think of. Was
that's the only thing she'd seen. That was the only way that she'd seen people move forward.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
so I don't blame people for that. They don't have the opportunity to even see what the opportunities are.
Yeah. You know, I was actually thinking about that a lot with, in the context of like migrant children. You know, you kind of get here and a lot of times because I am a migrant child, right? Your parents stay in the sort of the cultural enclave of first generation. You know, we speak Spanish at home. We have other friends from the homeland. And the consequence of that is that the children really have no one to socialize them in the new country, you know? And so it sort of leads to a certain type of poverty of mind where you kind of can't imagine what is really out there for you, you know?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that the military generally does for people is they uproot them. You know, they displace whatever your cultural upbringing is, and they lay this very, very command and control oriented structure on top of it. And they, you know, it's one of the reasons why they put you through that 6-week boot camp. It's, you know, it's to break you down and to make you really adopt a new series of norms. But, you know, it also has traditionally been a way that people who are otherwise really out of any of the other opportunities move forward. And it's why it's such an honorable thing in this country that we have a volunteer army and that we actually have used it as a way to help people to actually get out of whatever they're stuck in and to move forward.
Right, right.
But I'll go. I want to go back to your comment about a poverty of dreams, because I think that's where we are right now in terms of energy. And I think that we actually are stuck on renewables and the opportunities are so much larger, but people don't have anything else that they can conceive of except for buying more renewables. And, you know, our challenges here are really around reducing air quality problems, you know, getting rid of pollution and making the air cleaner and easier to breathe, and also keep carbon out of it. And the two things can go together. And so it's not just enough to buy a lot of new renewables, because we can get to 100% renewables here in California and still not hit our 2030 GHG reduction goal. You know, if you look at where carbon comes from, only 20% of it in California comes from the electric industry. We've done a pretty good job of cleaning it up overall. 30% comes from the use of natural gas in homes. So people will fight against a natural gas power plant, but they're actually using gas in their homes. They turn on that burner, and there's methane.
Right.
And so there's fugitive methane and there's combusted methane in their homes. So we got to decarbonize buildings. And then the big one is transportation, which is 40% of all of our GHG emissions and a huge portion of all of our other criteria air pollutants. And that's probably the biggest attack on disadvantaged communities. And we have to use clean electricity to displace the use of gas for heating and for cooling in homes and businesses and in industry. We may keep it there in industry for economic development purposes, but then we really have to decarbonize transportation with mass transit and through electric vehicles. And, you know, people got to get off renewables and start to focus on these other more difficult challenges.
On the actual consumers of...
Yeah, and make clean fuels from renewables the driver for the cleaning up in these other industries.
You said something that's interesting to me. How do we get gas out of the residential sector? I love my heater.
Well, there's lots of other ways you can heat, and we need people who can sell people home heating solutions. So SMUD actually was offering for a while a ground mount geothermal heat exchanger, and they were doing it to try to figure out how people would begin to incorporate in your house. It works really well. It's pricey, however, and that's mostly because there's not a real production of this kind of a technology that people can use. You can also reduce the use of gas through something like a on-demand gas water heater for your showers. You know, you can. There's lots of different tools people can use. If you got a swimming pool or a hot tub, you can go to rooftop solar thermal to provide your heating for the water rather than using natural gas. So these are all things that are really within reach, and probably would get cheaper and actually even better if we did the kind of scaling that we did around solar, particularly photovoltaic. And so that's what I'm saying, is there's a poverty of imagination about what we do, what we prioritize. That there's a point where, in terms of criteria air pollutants and criteria into GHG emissions, that per dollar spent on trying to get to that last 2% of renewables, we could do a lot more in terms of making people's homes cleaner and safer and healthier, and we could do a lot to actually clean up transportation.
So we're hitting a point of diminishing returns in terms of...
There's still lots of low-hanging fruit to be plucked everywhere, but again, most of the policy is focused only in one direction. And that's what I mean by the poverty of imagination that you were talking about earlier.
Interesting. Let's just dive right into that. Let's just dive right into the energy discussion. Let's maybe start with, it's my hope that we're talking to regular folks, you know, it's my hope that people not just in the capital policy community are listening to this. And I've
hardly used any acronyms. I've used GHG.
Yeah. No, you're doing great. But I thought maybe we could start with a little bit of a quick rundown of the history of the PUC, why it exists in the way that it does, and sort of like how that framework is sort of struggling to meet the demands of figuring out the next 30 years of energy.
So a lot of people tell me that we're there to protect consumers, and that's not completely accurate to the history of the PUC. We were originally formed to sort of reward franchises to people to build really big, expensive, long-lived infrastructure, railroads, for example.
Okay.
And so when they were building railroads, what they discovered is if you just left it to the private sector, they would always pick the really big, fat, rich markets, and you get two or three rail lines competing to service them. Most of them were driving down their prices, and you had a lot of failures, and all of a sudden you had no service. So to get that reliable service at a reasonable price and to be able to guarantee everybody access, you created this franchise. And you said, okay, you can have the whole state of California, or you can have this part of state of California, but you have to serve everybody. You have to go to all these different cities. You have to charge people a fair rate, and then you have to protect the infrastructure. And that was really the mission. And in return, what happens is these businesses then could say, hey, we have a guaranteed rate of return. Look, the state of California has guaranteed that we will get this rate of return. It's a fair one. It's built to actually cover the costs of building this infrastructure over time. But to get it started at once, they'd go out and borrow a ton of money. And they'd get cheap rates, cheaper than the state could on pay-as-you-go, simply because there was that franchise. And everybody could look and say, yeah, you will have that many customers. And yeah, they will pay that much. And yeah, nobody else is going to come in and compete. So, of course, you're fairly risk-free. We're going to give you access to cheap capital. So,
okay. How does that model fit with where we're going?
Not so well. So you have deregulation of the telephone industry and competition. So the competition investigation that we did 2 years ago demonstrates that in urban settings you may have as many as seven choices of a telephone provider and four choices of some type of broadband provider. It gets much thinner, however, when you go to rural communities, and particularly rural communities, low-income rural communities.
Okay.
So that's the flaw, is that you get cheaper prices, you get competition, you get faster uptake, and you don't have to have a state-run monopoly. But on the other hand, you start to see that it's slower to expand and there's uneven development in a lot of other places in the state of California. And that, I think, is an example of where you get benefit from competition, but you start to lose some of the values of universal access and fairness to everybody.
So I thought it was a really interesting time at the PUC right now. You are sort of trying to lay the foundation on two different levels, right? You're sort of responding to various calls for reform in the last 5 years. The some members of the legislature even went so far as to introduce bills to sort of completely disband the PUC. But that's one of your tasks, is to sort of close the book on reform and how do we move forward from that. But at the same time, you're addressing really meaningful policy questions in terms of how do you set up the grid to rejigger, if you will, for distributed energy generation, for sort of the grid 2.0, right? So you're sort of laying the foundation for the future in two different areas. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, there's a variety of things that are going to be continuous. And so I'll just say that change is going to be continuous, and so that we're going to constantly undergo reform. The world is changing so fast that I don't think that the model that we use, the one that was in the state constitution, the one that we were formed to, can keep up with the changes in technology. So we have to adapt to that. But there's also a concern about large financial entities that have too much market power and have too much political power, and we're there to damp it down. So that means that we have to have some degree of central control, and we need to have some kind of a process that is accountable in some fashion or another. We're always going to be unpopular. People don't like infrastructure. It's always big. It's sometimes noisy. It's in their view shed. They would rather have it go away, and they certainly don't like to pay for it. But on the other hand, they like what it does. They like having cheap, abundant, high quality broadband services is what makes the podcast industry possible now. All these new features in our lives that we like are really dependent on some of these new services. So there's a big tension and there's a challenge. I don't expect that the PUC is going to just disappear from the world of stress and tension and criticism. And I think we'll always be a little bit behind the curve. But I think that there are things that we are doing that are pretty important. And so I'll just talk a little bit about the grid. The grid, the electric grid, worked really well for 100 years and it didn't change very much. You know, one of the managers of a publicly owned utility, LADWP, pointed to a pole over in the corner of his lot, and he said that pole's been there since Thomas Edison walked on the face of the earth. He said he would recognize the transformer on it. And so that might have been a little bit of hyperbole, but that pole was kind of weak and frail, and it was 70 years old. On the other hand, in the last 7 years, you see the emergence of cost-effective technologies that don't depend on fossil fuels to provide cheap power. We are seeing contracts for 100 megawatt and above solar photovoltaic plants, the flat panels that are in the desert where you have fairly good clear skies large parts of the year. And the contracts are as low as 3 cents per kilowatt hour. That's cheaper than a new hot burning gas peaker. That's vastly cheaper than a new coal plant, vastly cheaper than a new nuclear power plant.
So what keeps gas peaker plants and these other plants sort of in business still?
They are not in business so much as profit makers. They fill in the blanks as our variable technologies bounce around. So that's the other side.
Steady generation.
They're not steady generation.
Not, okay.
They are not at all. They are used maybe 200 hours a year. And they come up mostly on hot afternoons. So they are an entirely different critter. They are used very infrequently to kind of deal with those hot days when the sun is going down and the solar panels lose their effectiveness as the sun gets closer to the horizon.
Got it.
And it happens fast. And so what you need is something that you can turn on and it goes from 0 to 90 in 60 seconds. And that's why you use these gas peakers. They're basically jet engines. And the old baseload power plants that people are thinking about don't exist anymore. They don't get built.
Okay.
They are an artifact of the Korean War era. So when you get rid of an old gas steam powered plant, basically you're losing about 3/4 of the demand, and you're just providing that peaking. So that's the difference. That's the real difference. And so it's kind of an interim step. You know, maybe the price of batteries will continue to come down in 7 to 12 years from now. You can do it by storing excess solar early in the day and then using it for those peak hours. But right now you don't have it.
What are the big obstacles to storing excess sort of variable energy sources?
Well, we've had some good storage technologies in the past. So you can pump water back uphill into dams at night when we have cheap wind power, and then you can run it down during the day when people need it in the late afternoon. That's been around for a long time, and actually we have a lot of that. If you look at most of the big dams, they have some degree of pump storage associated with them.
Okay.
They could be improved and made more efficient, but dam managers are really reluctant to make big changes because they don't get all the benefits of it.
Right.
And there's anything involving water is pretty contentious in California.
I'll bet.
So the new technologies are the distributed technologies like battery storage. But battery storage is still pretty expensive. And you don't just use it for storing energy. You actually use it for very specific kinds of electrical needs. Someday it's possible. But I would say that probably the best bet for battery storage is when we really electrify the heck out of transportation, and you can use all those vehicles, whether they're mass transit or they're people's personal vehicles, as storage. And they go to work and you soak up there, and then you come home and you actually pump it back into the grid and sell it back to your neighbors. At that point, the electric utilities, the electric utilities in California haven't owned generating power plants for quite some time. They just contract for it. At that point, the electric utilities are a big platform for people to actually plug their technology in and to share it with each other, and they kind of manage it in much the same way that the internet service providers and the fiber companies support the internet but don't provide you with actual apps and tools that you use on it.
Got it.
They're not content providers.
Can I ask you to do me a favor, maybe point this thing a little bit closer to your point this thing to you? It moves too.
Don't be
So that brings a question to mind for me, and you can tell me if we've sort of already covered this, but it makes me think about the sort of the grid as envisioned in the 1920s, right?
When it was one way.
It was one way.
It was right? one way from big central power plants that were owned by monopoly utilities because they were very expensive and long-lived. They would finance them. Then they had the wires and they brought that power to you. And it was one way. It was from
the dam or whatever.
It was from a big coal plant. It was from right. a big diesel plant. And it went from the plant to a transformer. And it went to a long power line. It got to the edge of the city. And there was a big intertie or a big substation. Then it went to a neighborhood substation. Then it went to kind of a feeder line. And it had a transformer on the pole. It took it down to 120 volts.
To your home.
And it's just kept stepping out to your home, to your business. It just kept getting stepped down.
It's just one a staircase. Way. It's one just way. A staircase. Yeah.
Now it's two way. So that grid that they envisioned back in Thomas Edison's day is now a two way grid.
How, what does that mean for the investments that we have to make in infrastructure for sort of what sort of engineering has to go into that? And are we keeping up with
so
that?
So a lot more intelligence. You know, okay. if you live on Cabrillo Way and you want to sell power to somebody that's three blocks over on 21st Avenue, four blocks over, because you have excess solar, you're not using it, you're not even there. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to have a smart inverter and a smart meter to say, hey, this guy's not using any electricity and we actually remember that he works till 5 o'clock. Somebody two houses over is charging their
it's running their podcast or
their
whatever.
Tesla. Yeah. Or they're running their podcast and they need electricity.
Is this all run through an app? How does this work?
To be decided.
Okay.
So some of this is starting to emerge, but at the scale that we're operating now, you don't have to completely automate it. But sooner or later, we will see that emergent Internet of Things. Now, that starts to say that it all requires a lot more data, as well as having the technologies that can switch power from one place to another. It has to be able to kind of say all the other transactions that are taking place. So it becomes like Waze is if you're a driver for
right. Lyft this is the quickest Uber. Way. This is the best way to
watch out because we're getting signals. There's traffic over there, or we can measure all the other Lyft drivers, and we can tell you that this freeway is getting blocked up, so we're going to take surface streets here. So that kind of data becomes real important for the electrons. And so the electric utilities have sort of become their own telecom providers. When they put in these new technologies, they're also putting fiber on their wooden poles. That competes a little bit, or it actually is being used in some cases by telephone companies. So Southern California Edison is trying to do a contract to sell some of their dark fiber on the fiber that they've installed on their poles, so right. that they can keep track of all these new technologies as they modernize the grid. They're trying to just kind of make sure that they don't let it sit there and be wasted. They're going to do a lease to Verizon.
Oh, very cool.
So that may actually get people places. But then you also notice that when you look at those phone poles, you see the electricity, you see the electric company's fiber for their smart meters. Then you start to see the old copper cables that carry just telephone service and the old copper the cable, the little thin line that used to bring you cable
okay.
when it was just entertainment. Below that, you might see a big fat fiber that is the new AT&T U-verse that brings you telephone, internet, and content.
Okay.
And then below that's Comcast fiber that brings you telephone, entertainment, and the internet. And you think about that, and that wooden pole now is not what Thomas Edison saw, which was providing power one way and just had a line on it and a transformer. It is probably carrying as much computational data as the whole United States saw in the year 1970.
Every on one pole.
Wooden pole.
Wow.
On every wooden pole. And so the pole and the connections that this fleet of poles provides actually becomes the more valuable part of the system. Yeah, cheap renewable electrons has less monetary value than that pole for your investment. And you get more out of it than you do out of a rooftop solar array. Rooftop solar array may give you some electricity, but you don't, it doesn't give you reliable electricity, because at night it doesn't do that. So you got to have those poles.
So every pole, it has the computational power to sort of run this new smart grid that's sort of helping.
That it carries will it. It's, you know.
Right.
Well.
But it's going to help folks arbitrage their energy, right, that they're producing, that they're selling, that they're buying. And they're, at some point, don't folks have to go with an energy provider that sort of like best fits their modeled usage of their energy use profile, and sort of break up that old monopolistic that franchise service model that you were talking about? This is what we call full retail choice, right?
Yeah, we're getting close to that. I mean, we're already starting to see that with the emergence of these community choice clean aggregators,
okay,
where people are buying their electrons from a local joint powers authority. And so people are mostly not doing it because it's cheaper, because it's really not a lot cheaper. It might be temporarily cheaper, but you know, as the value of the poles increases, then I think you're going to start to see the costs start to balance. Because again, your electric company doesn't, if you're in a regulated company service area, you don't really get your electrons generated by something that the utility owns. They contract for that.
Okay.
So, you know, it's a competitive marketplace. So the costs are going to balance out. What becomes valuable is the poles and the network. And the network operations. So, but it means you will be able to choose where you get your electrons from. You probably can start to do peer-to-peer transactions rather than having to go to this JPA. You can just kind of say online, you can program your home system, say, hey, I'm around this hour of the day, I need electrons now. Who's going to give me electrons? What's the price? And it'll all kind of be automated for you. We're a ways away from that, but I think we get there.
But it's coming.
Probably the step that we're going to see in between then in the Internet of Things is 5G communications. This is a broadband wireless technology.
Okay.
It'll probably be on the top part of your poles, and it's what will really make autonomous transportation effective. You know, you can do autonomous transportation now on the cell system, but when you have a lot of autonomous cars, that's just going to get overwhelmed by the relatively low bandwidth and latency of the cell system. This 5G technology is going to be a short range technology. It's extremely high broadband, high quality, but it's going to only go about maybe 300 yards. So we're going to have a lot more transmitters, and so the place that they're going to probably be is at the top of those wooden poles.
So all those communities that undergrounded their utilities don't get 5G.
They will probably be the last, because they're going to have to get electricity out of the ground.
Put it back on the pole.
Put it back on the pole. And then mount a transmitter. Then they're going to have to get the fiber cable to that same pole. Whereas the ones that the electric utilities, the poles they run, are going to have electricity. They're going to have fiber. It's going to either be their fiber or it's going to be a telecom provider. And then somebody can put a transmitter on there, and then your autonomous car can automatically know the fastest route, and it can know which autonomous car can get you the fastest, and it'll be more reliable because there's a lot more bandwidth.
Very cool.
Yeah.
On the you know, when I was doing a little bit of just research, just to sort of prepare for chatting with you, and I still feel underprepared, because I mean you're such an expert in this field.
All I do is listen to a lot more people about these things than you do. So,
yeah.
And it moves fast.
You, at the beginning of the year, in 2017, you gave a talk to your colleagues at the CPUC outlining some goals and some priorities for, it was almost like a vision statement, sort of like, you know, it was a great talk. Now that we have you here,
I don't remember it.
You don't remember it? Okay, that's fine.
But
what is the one for 2018 going to say?
I think it's probably fairly similar. I think that our biggest task is that we have to cause to be built the infrastructure that will help to decarbonize California's economy. We have to continue to build renewables, but we actually have to focus on the ways that people can use those clean electrons to power their needs, whether it's heating in homes and buildings and in industry, and to power their needs in transportation without the use of fossil-based fuels.
Okay.
And that's the big challenge. We conquered renewable electrons easily, far more easily than anybody thought. So that the, if we just stop there, that's the poverty of imagination that you talked about before. If we don't use our skills, if we don't strain at these larger tasks, then it's really just a box that we're trapped in.
Okay. Okay. One of the things that the PUC is doing is regionalizing its presence across the state, holding meetings outside of the enclave in San Francisco. You guys came to town here, and you're also hiring up in Sacramento, right? Just for folks that are interested in this sort of stuff, you guys are still hiring in Sacramento?
We're still hiring in Sacramento, although we're running out of space. So we're busy trying to get our property manager to upgrade some more space in that building so we can continue to grow. We have a lot of folks who are retiring because we've had fairly good retention over the last 30 years. But it also means that a lot of people are approaching the retirement age all at the same time. So we really have to move quickly to bring new people in and to have them work with some of the folks who are going to be retiring soon so that we get that knowledge transfer and some continuity. But it's also important to do this in more parts of the state, because as these industries are decentralizing, we have to be closer to the place
where people live. To the regulated industries, yeah.
Who are going to want to use these industries so that we have a better sense of how it's working for them, because it's not going to be even. Goes back to what we were talking about, the city adoption, is going to be uneven. It's the like science fiction writer once said, the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed. And I think that's the condition that we will see over and over and over again. And if we don't get closer to people and learn how they need to use these technologies and how it can reach them, then we'll probably fail to actually keep pace with people's needs.
Very cool. Very cool. Just talking about staffing up the PUC a little bit, and it's going to segue into my next question.
It's a challenge. It's a big challenge. I've been describing it as I described the big challenges that we face, and some of that is around emergent safety risks as we start to see the effects of climate change here in California with more frequent storms and more severe storms and more frequent firestorms. We've never had fires like this in December.
Yeah.
The fire season. This is eerie. Yeah. So this is a big challenge, even on the safety front, which you would think would be kind of stable. You know what to do and you do it. Well, I'm sorry. It's all changing.
Yeah.
But, it is an existential issue for the CPUC, given that we're in an arena where technology and markets and decentralization is moving quickly.
Okay. I'm gonna say this, it kind of segues into my next sort of topic here. But when Trump was threatening to lay off all those folks over at the United States EPA, and just kind of shut down the climate change program, right? You flew over there. You flew over there and you stood outside with the sign that says, "Hey, do you want to continue to fight climate change? Come to California." And the reason I wanted to talk about this is because you've kind of always been an organizer at heart.
Yeah,
I'm
building those coalitions to try to help meet people's needs. That's what Joe Cerna wanted me to do.
When you first came to the when you were first appointed to the CPUC, you stood outside the CPUC with leaflets, right? You said, "Hey, what do you want to see change? I'm your new president."
All change has to start with people telling their stories to each other. And so, it's one thing to just say, "I am the head of this large organization and I'm going to tell people what to do." It's another thing to go out and talk to them and figure out what it's going to take to change. You know, for me, the reason I was in D.C. was actually to go to a conference. And I have to admit that I already had my plane flight paid for by the conference organizers. The National Association of Regulatory Utilities Commissioners was kind enough to be patient with me when I kept showing up late. And I just said, "Oh, I'm going to be in D.C. and the president's going to announce his budget cuts in his State of the State." You know, I just kind of figured out that that's what he was going to do. So I said, "Well, we need people. Let's go get them." And I got people to give me some, help me make some flyers. And this is a learning experience. Never have an economist make your flyers for
you. I'll bet. Yeah.
You know, they got the colors right, but it was a little jarring. It wasn't the image I would have liked to portray, but it, you know, got people's attention. So I got there, and unfortunately, you know, I'm a Californian. I didn't get it. There was a snowstorm coming. And so I went out and I saw how cold it was. So I went back and blew up a couple of my flyers so I'd have a sign. I was just going to hold the sign up and in one hand and hand out flyers in the other. And so, it was really cold.
It looked cold from the pictures.
Yeah. And I'm just standing outside this metro station near the Department of Energy. And all of a sudden, people started showing up. People who I worked with on energy stuff when I was in the governor's office had heard I was there, and they actually showed up. And
hey, would you believe what Michael Picker is up to today?
Yeah, they said, "Well, I'm going to go check this out." And a couple of people who I didn't know showed up. And it turned out, you know, we went out for coffee after I got done, and you know, these people who showed up had heard about it on some email chain that was mostly former Obama officials who were looking for things to do. And they said, oh yeah, that makes sense. They should go to work in California. All these people are going to get laid off. And so they came and helped me. Now, their problem is that they were smart and they knew how to link together online. None of them knew how to leaflet. And so we're standing there in this freezing cold wind with
snow. People forgot how to do the old school stuff.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, okay, fine. It's not hard. Just stand in their way. You can't, when you want a leaflet, you have to capture people's attention. So if you stand off in the corner and you don't engage with them, then they don't know what you're there for. And it was amazing. We had conversations with people in this driving snowstorm. The second day when I went to US EPA, more people showed up, including the president of a major solar company who just stood out there and helped me to leaflet.
Very cool.
And then more people I didn't know, but other people had heard and seen the flyers from DOE and they rode their bikes past EPA to come and look for me. And we've hired about five of them.
Did you really?
And one of them is one of my top staff people working with me on a daily basis. This young woman, Needy Takkar, who was the number three on DOE's solar program. And they're great people. They want to keep working. They want to keep doing what they're good at. They're not focused on what it is that Donald Trump's doing. They're focused on what it is that we can do to keep moving forward, which I think is a very potent kind of a message of hope. And it's the way we should frame our agendas. Don't spend all your time looking at what he's doing. Let's continue doing what we do. Do it well. And when that kind of negative program that he's building in D.C. collapses, we will be there.
How much of what you do is to just sort of captivate people's imaginations and let them know how, you know, what's possible? When I was with you, you turned your office up on the executive level of the PUC into a meeting room for your staff. And then you took a cubicle on the second floor with the rank and file. You also hold yourself out regularly to just have breakfast with rank and file employees and just talk, right? That's a real contrast, as I understand it, to the previous leadership.
Well, there's different styles of leadership. And a long time ago, I read this really interesting book by John Keegan, who was a military historian. He was comparing Alexander, who was sort of as all personal, but it was kind of dictated by the military technologies of the time. You know, it was like he had to get in front of people so they could see where they were supposed to go. And so he got wounded severely. You know, you get to Wellington, and they've sort of learned a little bit about how you can train staff officers and you can drill, and then you can actually stand on a hill and see how the enemy is moving around, and you can redeploy your forces. And then you get to commanders like Grant, where you really start to have industrialization. And so one of his strengths is he knew how to use the railroads to move large masses of people and material really quickly, and telegraph so that he could actually have people who could look at large concentrations of his opponents. So it's really, how do you use these new technologies in particularly around how you reach people? But at the same time, you know, you have to make it somewhat personal. That was one of Grant's strengths.
Having breakfast with your folks.
They knew that however crappy it was for them and how he was actually there in the mud with them. And it helps to know that they're not going to ask you to do something that they aren't asking themselves to do. And particularly when you're changing and it's really painful and it's not clear what's going to succeed and what's going to fail, and you're still trying to learn these things, it's probably helpful just to know that your leaders are willing to put up with the same.
Let me ask you something from an organizing perspective, and I'm actually not sure if you're allowed to answer this. I think it's closed though, so I think you can. How did the PURAs do?
They did great.
Yeah, because they wanted to just to contextualize this for folks.
These are our public utilities regulatory analysts, and it's by number the largest number of staff. Although we have large groups of other folks, including some of our rail inspectors.
But they wanted a 30% raise.
Yeah, they wanted a 30%
raise.
They got 23.
Hey, that ain't bad.
Yeah. It's still they're still having a hard time surviving in San Francisco.
I'll bet.
But
you know, everyone I met when I was there, I'd pull people out, you know, hey, you know, if you don't, after you, you know,
yeah,
after some rapport, right? After you establish some rapport, hey, what's your living situation out here? How do you, everyone I knew was like, oh, you know, my grandfather owns his home outright, or oh, I'm in the one rent controlled space that I could find somehow. It's like they won the lottery, or it's like, oh my goodness, I'm commuting from Hayward. You know, it's rough.
Well, I get it. I basically live on Amtrak's Capital Corridor.
Yeah,
you know, I live in Sacramento, but I work at least a part of the week in San Francisco.
Yeah, what did the PURAs do right, and what they do wrong from an organizing perspective?
There's a lot of things. I think that it was really them developing their own leadership, and so I think that many of those same folks are the core, are the key people who will bring change and new strength to the PUC as the world changes around them. So I was very proud to see that they actually are successful, and I was very proud to see that some of the are very active in continuing to talk about other changes that are needed at the California Public Utilities Commission. But they first needed is they really captured the attention of the union. And I think the union finally understood that they need to, this is Service Employees International Union, they need to really pay attention to some of these professional workers who are their members, as well as the rank and file clerical who are much larger in numbers. Because those are people who are going to help to make the union strong under the kinds of attacks that we're going to see from the federal government in this day and age. You know, the courts are really massing to kind of break the union's ability to have political strength.
Right.
And so here they used that. And they used it to both get the union to pay attention to them and get the union to again go to the bargaining process.
In a meaningful way.
As managers, we're sort of frozen out of that. We could make the arguments internally, but we're not allowed to talk to the union. We're not allowed to advocate politically. We can only talk to the bargaining folks.
So they had to get real buy-in from the top of the union to meaningfully engage on their behalf,
and then
also captivate your guys as a matter. I mean, well, they would come into the meetings and just
they would get up and talk, and they would be confrontational. They'd say, "We're not going away. This is a critical thing to do." We recognized it, but I think the message finally got across to the state bargaining folks. And I think it also got through to the legislature that this is a dynamic new force and leadership that we needed to keep in state service, because they actually also adopted the contract that finally got bargained.
They did.
Yeah, so I think it was real important. And then the thing that really impressed me is that once they got the win, they really de-escalated. So this is a hard time sometimes for folks to understand, is that you get to your goal, particularly in union organizing, and you got to kind of de-escalate and continue to build for something else. But you don't want to spend a lot of time just kind of fighting over the same fight. You got to kind of start to build and move on to other kinds of fights, and to use your political strength in the right ways. You know, you got to figure out where is the real next threat. Where is the real next need? You don't want to just kind of keep shouting at the same people when you got what you wanted.
Got it. You know, it's a treat to have you on, because you are such a you're so, you you you're just such a political mind. When I was working for you, you went over to Nevada to walk some precincts for Hillary, and the day before the election, you said to me, "God, I don't know about this."
Yeah,
and you were like the one person you were the one person I knew that was a little bit nervous about Hillary's chances. If you'd read the papers, you wouldn't have any sort of idea that Trump was about to win. But you called it. Can you tell us a little bit about what you were seeing and what you're seeing going into 18?
Well, one is that the decline of the traditional news media and the fact that people get information in a variety of different ways. But the quality of the newspapers, which then the newspapers tend to drive the normal TV news, is just really, it's very sad to see. And so you don't have that kind of source that people trust, and people find information elsewhere. Second thing that I noticed is that, you know, because I started to have lack of trust in what they were saying. Second thing I noticed is that while I thought that there was a concern about Donald Trump, I didn't see it translating into action. I didn't see African-American turnout in the way that I would have expected to. And I when I started to see that the numbers and the kind of excitement in particularly in eastern states where there's a very large African American population and they constitute a significant majority, that it wasn't there. You know, what I did see was that the unions in Nevada were actually getting their folks geared up and mobilized. I didn't see quite as much excitement in the same communities that I was in for Barack Obama's first campaign. So that's when I really started to worry about it. It was just
enthusiasm gap.
Yeah, and you get a lot of narratives in the newspapers, but you didn't have anybody on the ground who really could tell you what people were really thinking and doing. You got a lot of stuff about scandals and a lot of stuff about who said what, and so that doesn't translate into voter behavior. That got translates it. Into media behavior.
Got it. What are we going into in 18 in your view?
I wouldn't be able to say right now. I spend a lot of my time just kind of focusing on the organizational stuff. I think that the trends aren't really fully emerged, but I think that you are starting to see fractures in the right wing machine that so totally swamped the Democrats in the last election. But I don't know what the Democrats have to show yet.
Okay. Well, we're coming up right over an hour, so just in terms of wrapping this up, couple more questions for you. We'll let you go. Your term ends in 2020.
Yes,
is that right?
Don't make it that long.
Yeah. What does life after the PUC look like for you?
Oh, you know, there's always something to do. You know, I mean, I'm when you said I've got a political mind, I think you're probably overstating it. I've just made, you know, I've learned a lot. You know, good judgment comes from experience, and experience, unfortunately, comes from bad judgment. So after this, I'll just go out and make a whole set of new mistakes until I start to get it right.
Very cool. I do suspect that there'll be a number of young, ambitious staffers listening to this. You have been a chief of staff. You've been an advisor to Governor Brown. What advice do you have to young staffers and to people that are in the business of sort of being an advisor to an elected official?
You know, good policy
or an appointed official.
Good policy is always noticeable. And good bosses always are willing to let you have more slack when you come up with good policy, and then you can effectuate it, because good policy has to be something that can actually trigger action. And so when they start to see that, then they give you more support, more action. And you know, sometimes you get bosses who are a little flawed, and they don't always notice it, or they attributed it to the wrong person, where they get threatened by it. But on the other hand, you know, somebody who's really good will kind of help you and teach you and point you in the directions where they think you're going to help them. And Joe always said that he was never afraid of having good staff who got stuff done. He always thought that it reflected well on them, and he always just kind of would support me and say, okay, now I'm kind of dubious about what you want to try, but let's see how it works.
Very cool. Well, that's it. That's been our episode with Michael Picker. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good point to end it on. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Well, thank you. It was fun.